Well, I'm coming to you live from the Lenoir Parks and Recreation today to talk with you a little bit about progressivism. You know, think about it. The root word of progressivism is progress. And at the turn of the century, from the 19th into the 20th century, the idea was progress. You had new inventions, new technologies. America was moving into the modern. A way to think about that is the skyscraper with the Otis elevator. It's a good example. The Otis Elevator Company was the greatest elevator company in the world. After all, they had put an elevator in the Eiffel Tower. You had Frederick Law Olmsted, the greatest landscape architect in America, designing some places like Central Park, planting trees at Biltmore House along the estate, Biltmore Forest, as it comes to be. You had the Wright brothers in 1903, you know, with the culmination of their work studying pigeons to develop gliders that could literally, you know, take them into the sky. You had Nikola Tesla with his electrical power. Eventually, you'll have Mr. Marconi with the radio. You had tremendous changes in public education. And more people will be going to school. School, whether day school or night school, becomes very important. You know, a good example is that Morrill Land Grant Act of 1862, which provided monies to southern states for colleges, like a North Carolina A&T, perhaps. You know, in literature and art, it was moving from more romanticism into realism. You have the great watercolors of Thomas Aiken. You have the great writers, Samuel Clemens, Stephen Crane. Samuel Clemens, otherwise known as Mark Twain, who will write his masterpiece in the 1880s, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. You have Stephen Crane, who writes The Red Badge of Courage. It only takes a few pages to read the realism of battle as depicted from the Civil War. You have Jack London with novels like The Call of the Wild and White Fang. And again, you have the great novels, the dime novels about the West. You know, progressivism will involve people who have more leisure time, like the middle class. So amusement parks were coming into vogue, like Coney Island in New York. You have the evolution of the Hershey bar. You have the formation of Coca-Cola and Pepsi. You have baseball and boxing, which happened to be the premier sports of the time period. You have an emerging mass media with William Randolph Hearst and Joseph Pulitzer, the sensational stories. We've talked in the past about the mail order catalog. So these are some examples of being able to move into the modern. Progressives were middle class. They believed in bringing issues up to the government so that the government could be able to change things by way of the people. And we talked in class some about, you know, as good as progressivism is, it will leave out fixing problems of race. And that issue gets left to some very famous African Americans and some white folk who come together in 1909. To found the NAACP, you know, as a part of the Niagara Movement that begins in 1905. But as we move into the 20th century, America is a segregated place as a result of Plessy versus Ferguson, as a result of those Jim Crow laws. While blacks were enfranchised after the Civil War, the decade of the 1890s saw a disenfranchisement of African Americans. Through literacy tests and poll taxes and grandfather clauses. One of the movers and shakers of this period was Ida B. Wells. Ida B. Wells was a very famous young lady. She watched three of her friends be killed in Memphis, Tennessee, and it moved her to begin an anti-lynching campaign. Ida B. Wells, very famous African-American woman, raised her younger sisters by herself while also working tirelessly to end the practice of lynching in America. And if you look at the data from the first couple years of the 20th century, particularly in the South, the number of lynchings do appear to be going down. The two great icons of this period for African American history and American history were Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois. Booker T. Washington was an accommodationist. He believed in gradual equality, gradual improvement. Booker T. Washington realized, in his view, that if African Americans were going to achieve full equality, they had to make an impact in the white world. And the way to do that was to get a solid education, to get involved economically in the communities, and go from there. So he struck out founding Tuskegee Institute. At Tuskegee Institute, you had the great black chemist, George Washington Carver, who I personally love because he taught Bible study every week in Carnegie Hall on the campus of Tuskegee Institute, which is now Tuskegee University. Booker T. Washington believed, and he delivered an address called the Atlanta Compromise. Washington proposed that blacks and whites could cooperate on certain economic issues while being separated on social issues. So he's an accommodationist. When you think about Booker T. Washington, remember the Atlanta Compromise. Remember this idea of accommodation and gradualism. You know, there was another school of thought among African Americans that said this was insane, that blacks deserved immediate equality, that gradualism and accommodation was just giving in to the white man. W.E.B. Du Bois, the first African American to graduate Harvard University, believed in the talented tenth. He believed in a hierarchy of very talented African Americans that could lead the way to equality. And it's his work through his writings in The Crisis, a very famous publication. He will organize a Pan-African conference in 1918-1919 in Paris. And years before, in 1909, he will help found the NAACP. Booker T. Washington wrote a book called Up From Slavery, where he reminded his readers that he had been born a slave, and he watched his mama be a slave and work as a slave. And so accommodation was a way to, in his view, get out of that subservient lifestyle. To W.E.B. Du Bois, who wrote The Souls of Black Folk, it's not about that. It's not about getting out of servitude. It's about immediate equality and standing up for your rights. But these were two of the biggest icons of this particular time period. Another big icon was the celebrated African-American journalist William Monroe Trotter, who will later organize a bunch of protests against the biggest movie in 1915. In 1915, the longest reel-to-reel running movie, again it's a silent film, is D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation. Birth of a Nation was done in two parts. The first part tells the stories of two families during the Civil War. The second part pretty much celebrates the Ku Klux Klan. William Monroe Trotter was absolutely going to have none of that. And so he practiced civil disobedience in movie theaters in places like Boston to obstruct the showing of, in his view, a very racist-minded film. And it was. In fact, if you remember, talked about it in class, Birth of a Nation was the first film shown in the White House, and Woodrow Wilson absolutely loved it, called it history like lightning. But it was a terribly, terribly, terribly racist film. As stated before, progressives were middle class. They believed in bringing issues up to the people so that the people could change things, okay? And so whether this was clean water, social living, the right to vote, temperance, prohibition, it's very important for you to know that progressives could be black, they could be white, but largely they were middle class. And make no mistake about it, women were involved in virtually every facet of progressive reforms. You know, at the turn of any century, people do crazy things. And, you know, one of the things that was a part of progressivism was an emerging socialist movement in America. You had Eugene Debs, who was very active in the American Socialist Party. You had the IWW, the International Workers of the World, formerly known as Wobblies, who campaigned for better working conditions. You had artists and writers like Henry George, who wrote Progress and Poverty. And, you know, he's focusing on some kind of single tax to better society. You have Edward Bellamy, whose book is still in print, wrote a book about looking backward. And in looking backward, you know, having a better society. Progressives emerged in a large part around the social gospel. Remember that the social gospel is taking care of the poor and the needy. Taking care of the ills of society. Okay? Remember, this is opposite of social Darwinism. Social Darwinism said that, hey, some groups are just naturally better than others, and the government doesn't need to get involved. Progressives thought differently about that. And a group of people that really were in charge of exposing the problems in society during this time was a group of investigative reporters. And Teddy Roosevelt, President of the United States, called these investigative reporters muckrakers. They're raking up the muck of society. So if you are Ida Tarbell, you're writing in McClure's magazine, and your sole goal in life through your writing is to crush John Rockefeller's company, Standard Oil. And Standard Oil will be broken as a trust in 1911. And why did Ida Tarbell do this? Ida Tarbell made it her mission in life to crush Standard Oil because her daddy had been crushed in the oil business by the Rockefeller Company. You could be Lincoln Steffens, and you're writing about local government corruption. And so his book, Shame of the Cities, really brought about the realization of the corruption in local government. You could be Jacob Riis. Jacob Riis wrote How the Other Half Lives, about immigrant living and slum living. You could be Upton Sinclair, also a socialist, writing The Jungle, about the ills and the dangers of the meatpacking industry. You know, these were exposés. They weren't perfect. Some of it was sensational, much like the yellow journalism that we talked about when we dealt with imperialism, but it got people's attention, and that was the goal. Okay, so Teddy Roosevelt later coined these investigative reporters muckrakers. One of the most important government reforms during this particular time was something called the Wisconsin Idea, developed by Governor Robert La Follette. And Robert La Follette came up with things like the initiative, the referendum, the recall, you know, direct election of senators, which will later be an amendment, the 17th Amendment. But government gets more organized during this particular time, particularly local government. You could be organized around a commission government where you have different departments, and each department kind of reports to a county commission, and the county commission makes decisions. Or you could, more locally, you could have a manager government that was developed or designed into different departments like water and sewer and electrical or recreational. And each one of those departments will report to a manager. So you could have the commission government, or you could have the manager government, and these were ways to try to make government more responsible to the people, to better control public interests. For the voter, you had voting reforms like the initiative. Initiative is where people start a law. You know, you get enough signatures, that proposal goes on a ballot. Referendum is where the government puts ideas on the ballot for people to vote on. You know, again, think about this theme, government being more responsible to the people. You have the recall, where voters can choose to remove a leader if necessity proves that it's a good idea. This just happened in California several years ago now, when Governor Gray Davis was recalled by the public, booted out of his job, and replaced by in a popular vote by a guy by the name of Arnold Schwarzenegger. Again, direct election of senators will be the 17th Amendment. And what you see with initiative, referendum, recall, and direct election of senators is that the people are gaining more of a voice in politics, that there'll be a decline in machine-governed politics, like a Tammany Hall, for instance. We will see that women's rights is a big deal during the Progressive Era. And the 19th Amendment, which will be passed in 1920, will give women across the board, across every state, the right to vote. As we've talked about in class, women in Western states got the right to vote first. But now in 1920, women across the board will be given the right to vote. And the language of the 19th Amendment is roughly the same as the language and the first proposal to give women the right to vote listed in the Declaration of Sentiments from the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848. You might remember that from M1. Well, you know, progressivism, middle-class movement, also designed to protect consumers. So you have new insurance regulations. You have new zoning laws that changes real estate. because real estate, there was a lot of racism in real estate. Real estate agents got together and decided where to sell to certain people. You have new building codes. For instance, you will have the origins of sprinklers in buildings to protect against fire. You'll begin to have mandatory check-in, check-out systems. You'll begin to have fire drills. It's with Upton Sinclair's writing in the jungle that you have the Meat Inspection Act and the Food and Drug Act. There'll be labor reforms. One of the biggest labor cases occurred in 1908, the case of Mueller versus Oregon, where the Supreme Court decided that women did have weaker bodies, and as a result, they needed to work less hours. Okay? But you also have limits on child labor with a 1916 child labor law. You have the first child labor law in North Carolina in 1902 or thereabouts. And another thing going on with work is by 1913 or thereabout, you have the Adamson Act, which limits people to an 8-hour workday. Other reforms that were established, you had the income tax, 16th Amendment. You had more regulation of trust with the Clayton Antitrust Act that closed some of the loopholes from the Sherman Act. And then you have a tax on illegal alcohol and the abuses of alcohol. Carrier Nation was a huge activist during this time, and she will be a part of something called the Anti-Saloon League. And the Anti-Saloon League's sole goal was to bust up saloons. No drink, no alcoholic. And another organization, a little less radical, was the Women's Christian Temperance Union. Now, I want to strongly encourage you to remember this one, the Women's Christian Temperance Union. The Women's Christian Temperance Union argued for prohibition. Temperance and prohibition is the same thing. And what it means is just, being against the abuses of alcohol. So the 18th Amendment comes along during the Progressive Era, and it's designed to prohibit the making and selling and transporting of alcohol. Well, just a little bit about the presidents. I'm going to try to stick this. I'm going to try to stick the presidents into one quick lecture with progressivism, simply because you'll be doing a class activity where we look at these three gentlemen, Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft, and Woodrow Wilson. Teddy Roosevelt is a very activist gentleman. He had been vice president under McKinley before McKinley is assassinated. He believes in the square deal, and the square deal simply meant to give everybody a fair shake. Okay? And the square deal was designed to combat the evils of society. One of the things that Teddy Roosevelt is very famous for is using the bully pulpit, cajoling people, working the politicians to get what he wanted. Remember, on the foreign side, Teddy Roosevelt's motto was speak softly but carry a big stick. At home, with legislation, the program is the square deal, and Roosevelt will use the bully pulpit. A good example of this is the way that Roosevelt handled the 1902 anthracite coal strike. This time, Roosevelt threatens to send in troops, federal troops, to make sure that the coal companies, were honoring their agreement with the workers. Remember, this had been the opposite under President Cleveland during the Pullman strike of 1892, where the federal government sent in troops to break up the strike. So 10 years later, it's just a complete reversal. Roosevelt was known as a trust buster, although he believed in good and bad trusts. He was very happy when the Northern Securities Company was broken up in 1904 as a holding company, as a dummy company, to store money and resources. This is a good example of his philosophy of being a trust buster. Roosevelt is very influenced by The Jungle, which was Upton Sinclair's book in 1906 about the evils within the meatpacking industry. And it leads to the 1906 Meat Inspection Act and the Food and Drug Act of that same year, which establishes the Food and Drug Administration. Roosevelt is a big believer in conservation, okay? He's a big believer in laying land aside. So in 1902, 1903, you'll have the Newlands Reclamation Act, and this was an act specifically to lay land aside for the people. Okay, one of Roosevelt's good buddies is a naturalist and an environmentalist by the name of John Muir. And John Muir and Teddy Roosevelt worked together to lay land aside for the public good. You know, one of the things Roosevelt believes in is if you do something, you do it for the most good of the most people. Roosevelt's best friend was head of the Forest Service. His name was Gifford Pinchot. These were two really good friends. They were boxing buddies, and they're both conservationists. Gifford Pinchot is basically the founder of the U.S. Forest Service. And his Forest Service guys will perform incredibly admirably during one of the largest fires in the United States in 1910. And there'll be a gentleman by the name of Pulaski. If you look at firefighting tools today, particularly from the Park Service, you might see a Pulaski, which is a half axe, half shovel slash hoe. But Mr. Pulaski served himself admirably during the fire of 1910, and there's a great book by Tim Egan called The Big Burn, which you may enjoy reading, which is a very human story about how people acted during the fire. But moreover, it's also about how Roosevelt and Pinchot and others were big conservationists and believed in laying land aside for the public good. Roosevelt was one of our greatest presidents. He talked in football terms. He talked about hitting the line hard. He talked about, you know, being a man in the arena, about daring greatly. And he was one of our most activist of presidents. His inauguration was the first to be filmed. He will be the first president to actively invite a black man, Booker T. Washington, to the White House to have an intellectual discussion. And he will change the course of history as a result of his activism. William Howard Taft is actually going to break up more trust than Roosevelt. William Howard Taft had been Roosevelt's vice president. In 1909, he becomes president. And even though Roosevelt was known as a trust buster, William Howard Taft will break up more trust. William Howard Taft really wanted to be a Supreme Court Chief Justice. And much later on in the 19-teens and 20s, he'll have that opportunity. And so, like a John Kennedy, William Howard Taft, another president, is buried in Arlington National Cemetery. William Howard Taft was also a very activist president. It'll be during his presidency that Standard Oil is broken up. It'll be during his presidency that the Federal Reserve will be implemented, along with Mr. Wilson's presidency. It'll be in 1911 when the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire happens, which was the largest industrial accident in New York City before September 11, 2001. It's something that we'll talk about. You know, when Roosevelt leaves office, he helps his vice president, William Howard Taft, get elected because he feels like that the country's going to continue to run on a Rooseveltian tack. It doesn't. Roosevelt comes back home from being on safari in Africa, and the country's different. More trusts are being broken up. Less land is being put aside for conservation. In fact, some land has been taken out of conservation. And by 1912, even though he pledged that he wouldn't, Roosevelt decides that he's going to run again. This time, though, he will not be running as the Republican candidate because Taft will be the incumbent Republican. And so that'll be a story here that I want to share with you in just a minute. Woodrow Wilson, a Democrat, okay, comes to power in 1912, okay? He will be inaugurated in 1913. He's a Democrat. And so that election of 1912 will see four biggies. Teddy Roosevelt running as a progressive. William Howard Taft running as a Republican. Eugene Debs running as a socialist. And Woodrow Wilson running as a Democrat. Now basically, you know, Roosevelt and Taft are Republicans. They're going to end up splitting that vote. And this is a great gift for Woodrow Wilson. You know, as Roosevelt is running as a progressive, he is outside Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He's going to give a speech during the campaign. He steps out of the car, and an assassin comes up and fires a bullet. Bam! And the bullet goes into his body. Roosevelt is asked about this. Sir, are you okay? He says, yes, I'm fine. I'm as fit as a bull moose. So the name for the Progressive Party in 1912 is the Bull Moose Party. And the Bull Moose Party supported women's suffrage, supported an end to child labor, supported labor restrictions, and wanted the government to regulate business. This was part of something called the New Nationalism. This was the Bull Moose Progressive Party platform in 1912. Wilson is opposite. He's against women's suffrage. He's for open markets, for letting, you know, the market decide the price, and he's not very much for a regulation of business. And this is called the New Freedom. So remember, New Nationalism, i.e. Roosevelt, versus New Freedom, i.e. Wilson. Wilson wins the 1912 election. He does certain things, like lowering tariffs. The Underwood tariff will lower the tariff. He allows the 16th Amendment, 17th Amendment, 18th Amendment, and the 19th Amendment to be passed. And in our next unit with Wilson, we're going to talk about the Great War and how Woodrow Wilson is president during the Great War. But the Underwood tariff, as a progressive, lowers the tariff. The amendments will change America during this particular time. The Federal Trade Commission will set itself up in 1914. The Clayton Antitrust Act, as previously mentioned, will close the loopholes in the Sherman Act and help regulate trusts and businesses better. But one of the things that we're going to talk about with Roosevelt, Wilson, as a progressive, is that a good bit of his second term, from 1916, to about 1920-21, is going to be taken up with the Great War. Said better progressively, the war to end all wars. We're going to find that there are two things that end the Progressive Era. And the two things that end the Progressive Era are World War I and the massive flu epidemic that's going to consume the lives of at least 40 million people worldwide following the Great War. And if you remember, the root word of progressivism is progress. And we're going to see that as a result of the Great War, people have some different feelings about progress. Thank you.